This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds, and to Mars in some cases. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's episode number 251 with Valentina Karga. She is a Berlin-based Greek artist, or should I say a Greek artist living in Berlin. And if her name rings a bell, it's because, in fact, she is yet another subject, I guess the third, from Max Haven's book. Max Haven, the four-time guest, recurring guest of this podcast. Valentina was profiled, or her piece, Valentina and Peter Invest in Themselves, was characterized and described in Max's book, Art After Money, Money After Art. And a great piece indeed. And in fact, I'm still mesmerized by the accompanying video that they put together, Market for Immaterial Value, which is the larger project, I believe you could say, that Valentina and Peter Invest in Themselves falls under. I will hopefully have that video again with Valentina's episode. I put it with the corresponding episode with Max where we talked about that piece, but definitely check it out if you haven't already. And again, the website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, the revamped and redesigned courtesy of Fionn Zurubica, theconversationpod.com. Go check it out if you haven't already. And you can see a few intriguing images from Valentina, including a couple of her very collaborative projects, which we talk about in this conversation, perhaps most notably, Holy Shit. It's the Temple of Holy Shit, a project that she worked on that did indeed literally involve shit, as you will hear about. So much to look forward to. We had this call over Google Hangouts, which I use and have been using for international calls. I don't like Skype if for no other reason than the fact that I can't use my usual software, audio software, to record. I actually have to get a proprietary version of a Skype audio software to do that, which I've done once and didn't really like how it worked. So all that to say that Hangouts has been a little funky for me lately, including for this call. So there are some sort of glitchy moments where it sounds kind of staggered, but particularly in the first half. But you can still understand the gist of it, and the second half is quite clean. So just wanted to give you a heads up about that. Apologies. We'll try to figure out the Hangouts issue for future international calls. But in any case, worst comes to worst, you listen to this episode twice, which I almost recommend anyway, because there's so much value in what Valentina is doing and what she has to say, particularly about the difference between working collectively and working independently and how those actually interact with each other. And apart from all of that, with her work, she's at least, if not literally changing the world, she is definitely constantly thinking about how we can solve problems in the world. And she actually has a background as an architect and design, and designers, I guess, I don't know if it's industrial designers or designer sort of impact designers, if you will, are really the kind of people who do look for real-world solutions. And indeed, she is doing that. So I think you will find this conversation pretty inspiring and intriguing, if nothing else, for the Temple of Holy Shit. And we revisit, from Valentina's perspective, Valentina and Peter Invest in Themselves, the gold coin self-investing project that they put together 6 years ago. But I think it lives on definitely in spirit, if not so much in reality. Some great old news coming up on the back end. And more. Thank you guys for being here. By the way, just a quick heads up, if you have tried to donate to the show recently via PayPal, it turned out we were having an issue with that link because of the switch of design of the website. That is now resolved. So you can feel free to use the PayPal button on our support page without issue. All right. Thank you guys for being here. Nice to be back. I hope you enjoy this very high-minded conversation with Valentina, and I will talk to you more on the back end. Stick around. Until then. How soon did you know that you needed to leave Greece, and how soon did you leave?
Well, I left for different reasons, you know, like I was first in Rotterdam. I did my internship there after school.
Right.
It's common to go out and do an internship and travel a bit. So I did that, and there I met my ex-partner. So we decided to move together to Berlin. Mm-hmm. Just because it would be too difficult to him to come to Greece without speaking the language, you know, so it was like very different reasons mm-hmm. that made me move to Berlin.
Right. Where was your partner from?
Yeah. From Belgium.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And this wouldn't by any chance be the same partner that you collaborated with on the project, is it?
Yeah, Peter Jan, yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I'm glad that's the case, because I was going to ask you about that later anyway, because the way that I came to encounter you, we might as well say now, you know, is your project Valentina and Peter Invest in Themselves, which is the artwork that was part of your market for immaterial value, right? So
yeah,
So you guys were romantic partners, and you were also artistic partners, right?
Yes.
What are the pros and cons to having those things mixed together?
That's a good question.
Take your time.
The pros are, of course, that you can, there is a lot of life and work mixing, no? But for artists, this is very common. And for me personally, this is not tiring, because I'm happy to think about things, you know, even until very late at night.
Yeah.
So for Peter Jan, being a graphic designer, he really wanted to distanciate more the work and his life. So he was seeing this from a different perspective. We had a little bit of a clash there.
Well, I was going to ask you, though, if you were the instigator of more of the conceptual side of the artwork, Valentina and Peter Invest in Themselves, or if it was really, you think, entirely collaborative?
Well, I think it was more collaborative, because it was really based on a discussion we had that a lot with the two of us at that time, you know, being young in Berlin and try to make to make a career out of nothing, basically.
Yeah.
And in a city where we didn't know anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So we were pretty much in the same situation, and also we chose for that. That's why we chose to move together to Berlin, that neither of us had an advantage. You know, it was like a neutral place.
It was a neutral place, right. Yeah, you weren't going, you weren't going to Belgium, and he wasn't going to Greece.
Yes. That's the story behind it. So yes, of course, I'm the conceptual artist, but actually a lot of my work is part of different conversations. And that was a really strong conversation in that part of my life. And it happened, you know, that Peter was very much involved in it, because we were sharing also a household together.
Yeah.
So somehow it was impossible to do this work and make it only Valentina invest in herself. You know,
it
was not possible, because it that was not my reality at that moment.
Sure, right.
So I was just saying that this question of precarity is still a big topic in our society.
Yeah.
So I think the work is still relevant, and it's still relevant for all the people that start their careers for where we were like 6 years ago. But it's still also relevant for me, you know, like, because of course I don't have a permanent professorship, and maybe when this contract ends you know, there will be again this kind of uncertainty, and to a larger extent, because I think it's not only economic. There is also a precarity in terms of if we're going to live climate change in general.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of uncertainty that comes from different places.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, the answer is always to look for and generate as more alternative solutions as possible. So generating, you know, parallel economies is definitely one of them.
Right, right.
I don't know if I'm so interested anymore in the art market as such. You know, at that moment, I was also investigating what we see through the work, you know, what this is, what this means. But at the moment, I'm in a place that I'm much more worried for other things.
Let me, you shared with me this document about your various projects, and you expressed at one point a real dissolution with control, I think, you know, and free will and autonomy, I think, even, you know, I'm mm-hmm. just kind of getting at the general gist of it. I'm not doing it perfectly, but I just want to mention that preface because you want another project that you talk about is this Institute for Spontaneous Generation and this manifesto that goes with it, The Currency is Dialogue. So the way that you mm-hmm. described that was putting value in relationships, conversations like we're having now, and communication generally. And I mean, that seems like a really radical alternative, or, you know, almost opposite to the market. You know, it's like the opposite of an object. Is this something that, feel free to correct any of what I just said, but is this something that has been growing in you? You know, is it partly a result of anything that happened since you started being a professor? Anything having to do with Valentina and Peter invest in themselves, or anything else in particular?
I mean, yes, that work, the Institute for Spontaneous Generation, it was actually the outcome of a workshop that I did in the frame of test unit in Glasgow.
Okay.
With international, I think we were members with an international group of people that came just to do that workshop, which was not, it was in a creative and artistic design related context, but it was mostly about thinking about alternative economies
mm-hmm.
all together.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you know, being inspired by my previous projects and having, you know, a guidance from my side, somehow it was like a collective work of art, which was actually it was flowing in a very fantastic process. It a little bit Dadaistic at that time.
Dadaistic, right?
But mm-hmm. yeah, because we were connecting many elements that we would observe from the local situation there in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And then based on my ideas from Market for Material Value to have, you know, shares, but through that also to generate an economy that is more about material things. So the idea was to turn, to create an economy around the waste paper of the city of Glasgow and to make new paper from it.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could potentially sell it as a handcraft, special handcrafted paper and so on. And, you know, so there was this kind of like more or less practical idea of what could actually happen in this frame of a circular economy. And on the other hand, there was a little bit of a Dadaistic approach, creating also sculptures out of these processes and having a lot of conversations with people. So turning it also to become a social piece.
Social piece. Thank you.
You
know, when you talk about your moving away from objects and your collective approach and so on, and I was, and you mentioned you were doing that piece originated out of working in Glasgow, but I was thinking about your being in Berlin and imagining that there are so many different art worlds there, and to what extent you are aware of them. Like, are you plugged into your own sort of socialistic, Dadaistic, and community-based kind of sensibility of the art world, and not really aware of the more market-based one? Or do you sort of find yourself inevitably drifting or flowing between different ones?
I would say that I'm more flowing between different ones.
Mm.
But you have also to take into account that I come from architecture. My background is in architecture, mm-hmm. and design.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a little bit of, although here in Berlin it is one part of the art scene, has to do with this kind of alternative forms of architecture that is a bit more impermanent, and it's about creating experiences,
mm-hmm.
of exercising things differently. So let me sum up, like, that there is a scene that relates a lot to architecture and the urban environment and the right to the city.
Yeah.
That is quite big and growing in Berlin. And it's, for me, it's very much, I say it more from the perspective of social engaged art practice, you know, and connecting it to this kind of movement.
Yeah.
But of course, there is many architects involved that see it from their perspective a bit differently. But that doesn't matter, you know, because it brings people together, and everybody from their own perspective can contribute to this. That is one art world that exists here in Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, you actually raise a question that I want to ask that's not really related to your work per se, but being a Berlin resident now yourself, I wonder, as somebody who lives in a big city in the United States and being aware of this phenomenon happening in big cities, as well as in some cases not so big cities in the U.S., where real estate is becoming completely hyper-capitalist, and the whole gentrification and the capitalist-based planning of cities and so on. And so all that to sort of set up, is this something that you see on any level happening in Berlin?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes. Mm. That's what we are trying to resist.
Yeah.
Towards. Yeah, it's... And Berlin has had the luck, let's say, to escape this happening, you know, in comparison to Paris or to London.
Yeah.
To other big cities in Europe. Berlin was still affordable until 5 years ago.
Yeah.
To buy property.
What happened? Like, what do you think happened about that time?
I was seeing some statistics recently that in the last 8 years, the prices went up to 8 times up.
Wow.
So it's really a really big pressure that has been put in Berlin in the last eight years.
Would you agree that increase is more a result of international activity than anything in particular related to Germany?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
And it's also related. In general, I think for me, this is one of the signs of accelerationism, that
right.
things go much faster.
Yeah.
And everything that manages to escape, you know, this hyper-capitalism, what you call it,
sure.
is now the time to become also part of it. You know, we're reaching the point of no escape, it seems.
Do you feel...
And
go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and for me, it's all related to also to climate change.
Oh, interesting.
The fact that mm-hmm. a very big turning point is coming up.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask...
Very soon.
Do you feel like...
So it feels that we are running out of time.
Do you feel, as an artist, though, working on these socially engaged projects, that including some degree of activism is either relevant, appropriate, or necessary?
Yes, absolutely. I think for me, all things are so interrelated. You know, these are just names, of course, but...
Right.
But I think a big part of activism is not only pointing out what's right or what's wrong, but also proposing new solutions, no?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's exactly what we need right now. New imaginations
yeah.
for whatever happens.
That's,
and I can tell you, yeah. like, regarding to that, I can tell you this story that from my experience with my very first group of students, because this was the first year for me as a professor.
Yeah.
And the second semester, our summer semester, so I wanted to work on a fictional project with the students and to see how they imagine the future, because we were reading a lot about the Anthropocene. And we were reading this fantastic book by Arturo Escobar. It's called Designs for the Pluriverse.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pluriverse is a term that comes from the Zapatistas movement.
Uh-huh.
But it basically means that, you know, that the world is not one big, one-sided norm. But, you know, many different economies, many different realities, many different lifestyles or worlds can exist in one world,
yeah.
and everything can coexist, no?
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking a lot about these kind of things, and we talked a lot about dystopia and utopia,
mm-hmm.
And I was keep on insisting, you know, to create a possibility not to see the world black or white,
mm-hmm.
you know, so not to create a very dystopic project, but also not to create a super utopic project.
Right.
Because none of this is actually what we're looking for, because we're again, you know, if we're acting on the very two far ends of the spectrum, we're again reinforcing this ontology of division,
mm-hmm.
you know, like it's this or that.
Yeah.
However, like what came out of this project, which was about the near future, so it was from 2019 and 100 years in the future,
mm-hmm.
was that almost all the projects were super negative and very, you know, like scenarios for Black Mirror episodes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. And this made me like really, really, really worried, because if this is really the imagination that we have about the future, you know, that things will become so dark that we, you know, a lot of people will die, and then we will use their bones to make new houses of, or that there will be drones made to point out to the few remaining nomads that survived where the next resources are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah. this kind of projects.
Yeah.
Then maybe this will actually happen, because this is what we are expecting and what we are creating actually in yeah. with our imagination.
Right.
But what was your question? Why did I start talking about this?
Well, I think this was something that evolved out of my question about the different art worlds in Berlin and how you flow between them. Maybe, you know, that was the starting point.
But then after that, we were talking about the accelerationism and the high prices of Berlin.
Yes, exactly, right. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy that the students are kind of observing, but then they're also kind of perpetuating this dystopian future.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the point, you know, how can we change our image of the future? Because it seems that it's already colonized from the movies into this post-apocalyptic, you know, like the future is always this post-apocalyptic, dark world, let's say.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if we can still escape this narrative. And of course, you know, if you connect the dots and what's happening with capitalism and the real estate and climate change, you know, things are pointing out towards that direction. But it's also like our perspective of looking at these changes so negatively that creates this. You know, because a change is a change. And no matter how terrible a change is, it's always a possibility for a new start.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
So, like, for instance, in Greece, no? I come from Greece.
I was just going to ask you about Greece, actually, and the economy there.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, like the whole world knows like how bad this crisis was, and it was for a long time in the news, the economic collapse in Greece and the crisis and, you know, people losing jobs. And it was really, really, really bad for a long period of time. And the mood of the people was really actually... It had changed a lot. You could really feel it. The vibe was really heavy, and there was a lot of pessimism about things, about the future.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, you know, of course, things had started to shift. Not because the situation changed. You know, the situation didn't really change. It's actually not so much more money flowing in Greece. But the people changed their mentality slowly, slowly. And they started creating places and projects that you don't need to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
Or it brought a lot of humanity and solidarity out of people. They, you know, like doctors creating solidarity clinics that very poor people can go for free,
mm-hmm.
and working after hours from hospital there for free. So amazing, really, or a lot of places to give alternative healing, you know, like acupuncture, three schools of acupuncture,
mm-hmm.
for instance. I know this because my mom was going to one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So very generous things, that very generous gifts and very generous skills and time that otherwise in other societies people won't give for free.
Right.
And this exactly makes this doesn't mean that suddenly Greece is out of the capitalist system and that the problem is not still there.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is still there, the debt is still there, everything is still there. But the mood has changed because the people started acting and creating a different lifestyle that maybe is not so dependent on the main system, and creating more possibilities and of supporting each other. There's also this amazing Biome project of the workers from a factory that went bankrupt, that then occupied this factory and started producing by themselves cleaning products that then they sell directly without, you know, having mediator companies. So a lot of good examples of different works, different ways of working.
Right.
And in a living, more community-based and less dependent on the system. So, but this is one side of it. On the other hand, there is a lot of pressure to the farmers to sell their land to big multinational companies and then work on them on a wage instead of, you know, themselves owning the land and being their own bosses, which is very hard because you depend a lot on the weather and a lot. You take the risk of all these unpredictable conditions. But recently I became part of the board of an activist organization in Greece. It's called Agroecopolis. And their scope is really systemic change in terms of food resilience, and create a community-supported agriculture network in Greece, because this is something that doesn't exist there yet. You know, to give more incentive and support to the farmers that want to keep on doing their own practices, to do that with the support of you know, community that buy their products directly from them.
Can you be doing your work as a board member when you're from Berlin, from Germany, or do you need to be there to participate?
No, because we talk a lot on Skype, and since I'm anyway going to Greece from time to time. The only thing is that I cannot be actively hands-on involved.
Sure.
You know, all
sure.
The rest, the meetings and the board meetings are totally fine. And I came to this particularly to help connect it more to the arts, because I know that, you know, in my scene, there is a lot of artists being working with socially sensitive subjects. And actually, when you work like that, you also need a certain context to work with people in a real situation. So this would be like an excellent place for artists to do a residency, for example.
Right.
So our plan is to develop a program for an artistic residency in Greece together with this organization.
So speaking of projects that you're involved in, are you still part of Collective Disaster, that group?
Yes.
Okay, because I really want to talk about, before we run out of time and bandwidth, I want to talk about your project, the Temple of Holy Shit. So was it connected to this summer school of applied autonomy in some way?
It was the aftermath.
The aftermath.
Of the summer school.
Okay. Well, why don't you just describe that project, if you would?
Okay. So Temple of Holy Shit was actually, it was a reaction to an open call for a public art biennale in Brussels. And two friends, Andrea and Luisa, were living in Brussels, and they said, hey, you've been working on the summer school for applied autonomy a lot around similar issues that these people are proposing for this year's Art in Public Space, Park Design, it was called, this Biennale. So why don't we team and propose something together? And they had a particular call for waste, you know, how do we deal in this park, park farm. The concept was a park farm with the waste. And it was anyway a piece of land that was undeveloped in Brussels, of course. And it was totally abandoned, but still in a more or less central place. So the idea was to regenerate this abandoned piece of land that was also, you know, the soil was also in a very bad condition. So we came up with the idea to create compost out of the bodily waste of the visitors of this park to then create nutrients for this soil to, you know, to plant new trees and new life in it.
Right. Let me just ask you, what was your awareness of a precedent for human waste as fertilizer?
So the previous history was from my experiences in the projects 30 Days in the Garden and the Summer School for Applied Autonomy, of course, and 15 Days on Mars, which was this whole my obsession of studying closed loop systems. And actually how nothing is really a waste and everything is a new resource. It just has to be transformed, basically.
Right, no? Right.
And this is a very important shift for me in my head, because we're scared that we're running out of resources, of this and that. But actually all the materials that have, or all the elements, you know, in an atomic level that have ever existed on Earth are still there, you know. So all the atoms of carbon, all the atoms of, you know, water or hydrogen or oxygen are always still the same. It's just that they are then being combined and recombined in different ways. So, for instance, a lot of carbon atoms have now been trapped into the form of plastic. You know, that cannot go back into the loop anytime soon by itself.
Right.
So it's just polluting because, you know, all this energy it contains and it's supposed to do things, somehow it's trapped in a form that is unusable.
Yeah.
After.
Yeah.
After it becomes trash.
Right.
So trash, actually, it's atom particle prisoners of form that cannot serve any longer. So it's not sustainable in serving something long term.
Yeah.
And it's also not able to go back into a form that can be reformed easily. Is that clear?
Yeah. So get back to the temple.
The temple.
Yeah.
So I was studying all these closed loop systems, and I even went to study this Mars-based simulator in Utah. The MDRS, Mars Desert Research Station, because, you know, to reach space and to colonize Mars, somehow a self-sustainable closed-loop system has to work perfectly because you cannot, the travel is very far, so you cannot bring all the resources that you need. So you need to regenerate resources in the spaceship. So that was the idea of the Mars Desert Research Station. So it was a very extreme example of actually what happens here on Earth. You know, everything is a closed loop system. And having studied this and tested this before in my own experiments in the garden, and then with a group of students in the summer school for applied autonomy. I have had a little bit of experience on how to turn your own shit into and kitchen waste, of course, into soil. And this of course is also a process that takes time and takes care of this alive microorganism, you know, that you don't see, but they are there, and they should not die, because if they die, then actually the work is not done. It's a little bit like having a pet. You have to take care of it and feed it, but not overfeed it, and so on and so forth.
So were you able to, even though that project, I presume, because it was on, you know, a guest site, was finite, were you able to generate any growth, small crops?
Actually, we reached the point that we generated the soil, because the problem was that the whole project, this whole biennale, was up for 6 months. And of course, you cannot finish such a process in 6 months. In 6 months, it's only starting.
Right.
So we went, you know, after the project finished, and we didn't have any more the, how do you say, the permission to be there and to be, keep on working on the land of this site.
Yeah. You couldn't keep working there.
Yeah, so we kind of moved this compost on the making under a bridge in a safer, let's say, safer spot, a little bit out of the public site. And we were in a long discussion with the local authorities to let us use this compost, and we even went samples to the lab to prove that is absolutely harmless to use it, and so on. But somehow it was very hard to then take the permission of the real authority,
right?
Because as long as it's for an art biennale, things are good. But then when the art frame, the art umbrella finishes,
right,
then very hard to proceed with the rest of the.
Yeah,
the bureaucracy, basically.
That's a very fitting example of how the art umbrella offers shade and protection. But anecdote. Let me ask you this: anecdotally speaking, do you feel like that you were able, you and your team were able to transform human waste combined with compost and soil to make it safe?
Yes. We tested this on the lab. It's absolutely safe, because for a large period of time, so these 6 months, you leave the bodily waste closed in closed containers. So this anaerobic fermentation, in which we had added microorganisms that we bought from the internet and we were cultivating to speed up the process, and charcoal is very important, because it from its own molecular structure, it has a lot of, it's like a sponge, no? So it has a lot of space for the microorganisms to live and survive longer and work to break down the bodily waste into something else. And and in this process, because it's high heat, the pathogens die. So only the good microorganisms.
I see. Is this one of the more scientifically involved projects that you've done? I get the sense that you've used science pretty regularly.
Yeah. I mean, in this particular project, we had with us Dr. Heiko Piplo and artist Ayumi Matsuzaka, that have been working together for a longer time in this terra preta composting researching.
I see.
And you know, and he's a scientist, and he also uses this in his own garden.
Ah, I see. Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a little bit far-fetched because we have this big taboo about human bodily waste.
Sure.
So I find that that's more of the problem than the chemistry.
Sure. Right. I get that. I get that.
The science is pretty easy.
Yeah. I understand. Interesting. So I'm a little concerned just about running out of time. So maybe we should try to have one kind of maybe final topic. And I guess I was just going to ask you, as somebody who has not only been very involved with collective projects, you know, collective art making, but also with your job as professor in Hamburg, doing, and by the way, I should just clarify this with you now. You're the professor for initiation of artistic work in design at HFBK. So I guess I just want to ask if you have any general guidelines about collaboration, you know, like how do you, you know, because it seems like you've done a lot of collaborative projects, but you were kind of, in some cases, the leader, you know. But if you're truly working in a collective or a collaborative process, what are your do's and don'ts as far as sharing, democracy, and that kind of thing? I mean, one of the things, for example, that I talked about with Max that I remember is, like, you know, you have a shared housing situation, and you know, you have everybody on the whiteboard with their different tasks, you know, but then maybe the person who gets kitchen duty is not so happy to have that role.
Yes. Well, this is a very, very good and complex question because indeed, I have had a lot of different experiences in collaborating. In some projects, I take more the lead. In some other projects, I'm more, more following. In some projects, I'm instigating and initiating, and then they flow by themselves. With the students, it's a very different question because they are there because they have to learn. And although our school is very free and we don't grade students, however, there is a kind of like a pass or no pass from the year I'm teaching, the first year of bachelor. So like there is a little bit of a pressure towards the general system, let's say, which also depends on all my other colleagues and not only on me. So there is like some expectations there.
Yeah.
But in general, if I have to say something, like my most honest advice also to myself, not to younger people or not to others, or, you know, like I don't say this as knowing it already, because I also sometimes fail to do it, is to really be super honest with yourself about what do you believe in and why you do what you do. You know, what is the meaning behind of all this? Why are you sacrificing all this time and energy to collaborate with others? And for me, it's really because we cannot save the world alone.
Right.
You know. But on the other hand, it needs a lot of work personally with yourself to reach this level to be able to work with others.
Yeah.
So it's a balance of these two things. And so for me, honesty, being clear, trying to understand that it's a balance of many people and many energies and many perspectives in this one thing, and not that this is not the place where you satisfy your ego or you discover only yourself, the limits of your own self, and only that. It's important in collaboration. But that's why I think one should also do at the same time individual work as well.
Yeah.
Because you, like I personally also have this need, and I also totally understand when others have this need too. And that's why with the students I'm trying, and also in all the participatory projects that I'm doing as an artist with an audience or a public or a community or a group of people, whatever, I try to create a situation where there is a general frame that I kind of designed, let's say. But then everybody is invited to contribute to this frame how, you know, however they want. So the frame is structured and clear, but then they are very free to bring as much or as little of their own selves as they want in there.
Yeah.
And this is the same what I follow with the students. Like we share a common narrative, for instance, but then everybody does their personal project, but within this agreed narrative.
Got it. Well said.
So, yeah, trying to combine the two.
Right.
Well, I wanted
go
to
ahead.
Say one more thing.
Sure.
Going back to the initial discussion about the project that we started from.
Yeah.
You were asking, you know, like, how things have changed since we evolved also. And I replied something about precarity in general.
Yeah.
But I wanted to also point out next to that it's not only that only I personally and Peter personally have changed and evolved in our art making and in our life, no? Both as artists and as people, but it's also about how the world is changing and how this collective self that we belong to, the collective understanding of the world of people has done, you know, like really big steps in the last 5-6 years. So, yeah, so sometimes, somehow I think, this whole discussion about the economy for me, it now it's much more connected, to the climate as well. And one cannot exist without the other.
Sure.
But exactly creating all these alternatives, to exist differently and to different designs, you know, because money and economy is also a design. So different human designs for our human-centered understanding is very important. And now I'm like working towards, you know, how to expand all this designs that I'm thinking of about the future, but also to include non-humans or more than humans, you know, kind of trying to broaden up the perspective and think of other forms of life and the whole planet itself as one form of life as part of this. Because I think, you know, if we are to survive this change, we will survive it collaboratively. But as we were talking about collaboration before, one also really needs to know themselves. So we also need to truly understand what it is to be a human being. And on the other hand, expand our views and designs, such as economy, as a design for for a larger crowd, including non-humans and other forms of life.
Well, I'm glad we got that last bit in without technological interruption.
Yay!
But I do, and I could keep talking to you to make up for time, but unfortunately I am out of it. But Valentina, it was great to be able to talk to you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you too. Yes, I really appreciate what you do with the conversation. I think it's super important to have open conversations as such.
Thanks again to Valentina. So glad that we got to have that conversation. And indeed, if and when I make it to Berlin finally after many years, she is definitely among the top few people that I will look up when I am there. So heads up, Valentina. Before we get on to the old news, I want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Your support is very much appreciated. The PayPal link is working again. There are various other ways you can support the show financially, and I'll remind you that we do have a recent bonus episode with Justin Anthony, the co-founder of Artwork Archive. So if you are interested in listening to how that works, how that platform works, how it got started, and so on, just shoot us a donation of $20 or more. If you want to get all of the bonus episodes, I think we're up to 11 now, minimum donation of $35, and you can do that either via PayPal, Patreon, Venmo, or good old-fashioned check. Just ask for our address, and we will supply that to you. Immense thanks to the regular donors to this show via Patreon and PayPal, who a few people have set up ongoing PayPal donations. Many, many thanks to you guys, as well as the annual donors, Carl Smith of River Gallery in particular. Thank you to all of you for your ongoing support. Your donation would be very much appreciated, especially if you have not donated the show before. I can hook you up with a P-word bumper sticker, a The Conversation Art Podcast bumper sticker as well, if you are so inclined. You can also support the show by spreading the word. Leave a great review on Apple Podcasts and the other platforms if you listen to another one, which is a good way for other people to find out about this podcast. But generally, your spreading the word is very much appreciated. And of course, you can follow the podcast on social media at Artist Podcast. Immense thanks to Andy Davis, producer, for guiding our Valentina and my spotty hangouts call to smooth continuity. Thanks again, Andy. Thank you to new producer Amanda Roth, who has recently joined the fray. And huge thanks to another new producer, mega producer Fionn Zarubica, who is guiding the future of this show as well. Thanks to all of you. And now let's move on to this episode's old news, courtesy of yet another producer, Megan Bickle. Thank you, Megan, for putting these together. All right, here we go. Starting with this one from 9/16. It's called Blank Space, and it is from, once again, podcast alum Tim Schneider of ArtNet. On Friday, the New York Times fleshed out a sobering finding that about 1 in 4 condo units completed in New York City since 2013 remain empty and available, with the majority of them in luxury towers. As it turns out, this statistic chimes with the performance of premier fine art auctions around the world in 2019. The condo vacancy figure comes from a new study of 16,200 condos in 682 buildings in NYC-only online real estate lister StreetEasy. More jarring still, the site's senior economist, Grant Long, notes that he thinks his team's estimate is actually, quote, really conservative, since it only counts buildings with sales contracts already closing. That means the data excludes the thousands of condos still under construction that are only likely to worsen the glut of high-dollar vacancies once complete. Of particular interest to me was one supporting stat much closer to the present than the overall figures. According to Stefanos Chen of The Times, Quote, from January to late August, there was a 35% drop in the number of contracts signed for new development at or above $4 million compared to the same period last year, unquote. Why do I care about this figure? I'm glad I can pretend you asked. At $11.1 million, a work by Jean Dubuffet was the top lot of the night at Christie's London Postwar and Contemporary Evening Auction in June. And that comes courtesy of ArtNet. So I guess that's the connection, the art market and the real estate market. I guess you have to do the math from there. Also from 916, go away and take your shitty forest. A massive environmentally conscious art installation in Austria is now being guarded around the clock after being targeted by right-wing politicians. Two hard right parties, the Alliance for the Future of Austria, BZO, and the Austrian Freedom Party, FPO, had publicly criticized the project, falsely claiming that the installation, which has filled a local soccer stadium with a grove of 300 trees, had been taxpayer-funded. The resulting public controversy has taken on alarming dimensions. In a recent profile with De Standard, Swiss curator Klaus Littmann alleged that he has not only faced verbal criticism for the project, but also been physically attacked on the street and pushed into oncoming traffic. According to the curator, his assailant shouted, "Go away and take your shitty forest!" As the September 8 opening approached, the BZO rallied supporters on social media, instructing them to gather in the front of the stadium during Littmann's opening and make a statement with, quote, non-functional chainsaws, unquote. In the end, the debut was a largely celebratory occasion, but as a result of the furor, the stadium is now being guarded day and night. I had not previously experienced such reactions, the Swiss curator told Deutsche Welle in an interview. Meanwhile, people have come to thank me and talk about the project. The reactions are still bitter on social media, though, where it's obviously easier to lash out. According to Littmann, part of the controversy has to do with the fact that the area soccer team, Wolfsburger AC, entered the Europa League and wanted to use the stadium, but couldn't because of the already scheduled art installation. Political parties picked that up and instrumentalized the issue in their election campaign, said Littmann. Mainly, however, the curator sees the uproar as political grandstanding, with the right-wing party spreading rumors that the project was sucking public resources, when in fact he has funded Four Forests through private donations. Quote, in the middle of the project, there's Sunday's upcoming election, unquote, he explained to DW. Quote, representatives of these parties were asked if they'd go see this installation, and they said, no. And it was apparently impossible to eradicate the falsehoods they kept chanting like prayers. That as well is from ArtNet. 914. Beware colonial guilt, Neil McGregor warns museums. Neil McGregor said that there could be unintended consequences when returning objects to their place of origin, as he disclosed that the loan of one of the museum's prize objects to Iran had led to violent debates and the jailing of the curator of the exhibition. Lending the Cyrus Cylinder, a 2,500-year-old clay Persian, quote, human rights charter, unquote, had led to political turmoil in Iran with arguments about whether the country should be celebrating a heroic pre-Islamic narrative. The director of the National Museum, where the cylinder was displayed, was removed from her post and imprisoned. That's from the Times UK. This is 919. Are you an artist? Well, we hope you're rich or beautiful. It turns out that creativity is actually among the least desirable traits in a partner for both males and females, at least according to a new study from researchers at the University of Swansea in the UK. The study, the largest test of its kind ever conducted, concluded that, on average, people are far more interested in kindness, beauty, and financial security in their potential mates. For Eastern and Western participants alike, creativity was among the three least desirable traits. The other two were chastity and religiosity. Across the board, kindness was by far the most commonly picked option of the bunch. Men more highly favored physical attractiveness, while women prized financial security. Humor was a much more popular choice for Westerners, as was the desire for children, while religiosity saw a higher number in the East. That is from ArtNet. 914, and this is Megan notes, I just love Martin Herbert. So here we go, a couple from Martin Herbert. Is it bad that when I walk into galleries now, I tend to think, so people are still doing this, huh? And again from 914, one thing I try to remember is that my nearest exit may be behind me. Also Martin Herbert. And finally, from good old Greg Org, the art fair will hold a sustainability pop-up in an archipelago of autocratic petro-monarchies in the desert. You know what? Here goes the usual. I guess that's all the autocratic petro-monarchies in the desert we have time for this episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. Do let us know what you think. If you're interested in helping the show, please do reach out to us. There's always room for an extra hand. And if you can support the show financially, it would be very much appreciated. Thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, ciao for now.